Yes, so the title of the talk is The Evolution of the Bodhisattva Ideal. And when I started preparing this talk, I had a question in my mind. And the question is quite a simple one, and it's who or what is a bodhisattva? So I turned, first of all, to try and find an answer to this, to Sangharakshita Thubanti. And I looked at his book, The Bodhisattva Ideal. And there, Banti defines a bodhisattva as someone who is totally dedicated to enlightenment, not for his or her sake alone, but so that they may lead all living beings to the same state of enlightenment. And upon the arising of the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, the bodhisattva starts upon their path, usually taking a set of vows, which is probably something like the four great vows. May I deliver all beings from difficulties. May I eradicate all passions. May I master all dharmas. And may I lead all beings to Buddhahood. And then on their path as a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva cultivates the six perfections, the six perfections of generosity, ethical uprightness, patience, vigor, meditation, and wisdom. And gradually, they progress through 10 levels or bhumis of attainment until, after many lifetimes, the bodhisattva becomes a fully enlightened Buddha. So that's the short answer to the question, who or what is a bodhisattva? And we could stop there, basically. But I'm a curious sort of person. And first of all, I ought to say that short summary doesn't do justice at all to Banti's whole approach to what it means to be a bodhisattva. And it certainly doesn't capture the spirit of what he capture about a bodhisattva. But I think it does encapsulate that summary, what I've taken for granted about a bodhisattva. And I think it probably also encapsulates what most people take for granted about bodhisattvas, whether they've been brought up on Sangharakshita's teachings or on the teachings of others. And the summary of the bodhisattva that I've tried to give you is very much the picture of the bodhisattva that you will find in that very famous work, Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara, his poetic evocation of the way of the bodhisattva. So what Sangharakshita says about the bodhisattva, what Shantideva says about the bodhisattva, that's what I've tried to give you, basic features of the bodhisattva. But in the last sort of year or so, I've become quite interested in reading about the history of the development of the Mahayana. And I particularly got interested in the writings of one particular female American professor of Buddhist studies, a woman called Jan Natier. She works now at a place called the International Research Institute for Advanced Buddhology. Sounds great, doesn't it? That's a university, a Buddhist university in Japan. That's where she is now. And she's written this really intriguing book called For a Few Good Men. And this is a translation and an analysis of an early Mahayana sutra called The Inquiry of Ugra, the Ugra Paripritcha, the Questions of Ugra. And I've also been intrigued by an article of hers, which she's published, called The Indian Roots of Pure Land Buddhism. So she's a specialist in the early development of the Mahayana in India. So I've been reading her, and I've been digging into the Pali Canon as well, going back to the early writings of the Buddha, the early writings of the teachings of the Buddha, and reading them. And I've been looking more carefully as well at the diversity of teachings that are contained in the different Mahayana teachings. And what I've begun to realize is that this sort of notion of a bodhisattva, who a bodhisattva is, that notion has a history. And that history is not always consistent with the summary view of the picture of the bodhisattva that I gave you earlier. And it has a history which has implications of which previously I wasn't fully aware either. So what I'm going to give you this evening is a look into the history of the development of the ideal of the bodhisattva. It's not the only possible history that you could get, and it's not necessarily the only true history. The way history develops, we can never be absolutely sure what happened, but it's a version of the history of the bodhisattva ideal. So that's what I'm going to give you, and I'm also going to give you some reflections on what this history might mean for us now. So I'm going to start this history in the Pali Canon, in the earliest record of the Buddha's teachings. And when we read the Pali Canon, what we find is that although the Buddha was seen as being superior to his enlightened disciples because he alone had rediscovered the path to enlightenment, in that sense he was seen as superior. In another sense, he was not seen as superior to his enlightened disciples. The nature of the Buddha's enlightenment was seen as being as the same as the nature of enlightenment of his disciples. They were both referred to as arhats, those who are worthy of respect. So the Buddha's enlightenment and the enlightenment of his disciples was seen as being of the same nature. And the nature of compassion of the Buddha was also seen as being the same as the nature of compassion of his enlightened followers. Both the Buddha and his enlightened disciples went out to teach the Dhamma, to spread the Dharma around India, to help others to gain enlightenment. So his disciples, the other arhats, had just as much compassion as did the Buddha. When we dig further in the Pali Canon, we find that there's a sutta called the Mahapadana Sutta, which is in the Digha Nikaya part of the Pali Canon. There's a description of a dynasty or a lineage of past Buddhas whose history and lives and attainment of enlightenment follow a consistent pattern or archetype right up to and including the Buddha Shakyamuni of our era. So there's a whole history of Buddhas previous to the Buddha Shakyamuni who had very similar lives and experiences leading to enlightenment. And to complete the dynasty or the lineage of Buddhas, when we look elsewhere in the Pali Canon, in something called the Chakravati Sihanada Sutta, we find there that the Buddha foretells of the next and future Buddha, the Buddha Maitreya. So to complete this line of Buddhas from the past through to the Buddha Shakyamuni, there's this future Buddha, Maitreya, who is waiting to come back to us and reintroduce the Dharma in the future. And when we look further in the Pali Canon, we find the Jataka tales. Now, you might be familiar with the Jataka tales, the stories of past lives of the Buddha. And in particular, when we look into the Jataka tales in the Pali Canon, we find the story of how in the distant past, the future Buddha Shakyamuni, as a Brahmin youth, prostrated at the feet of the Buddha Dipankara. He prostrated at the feet of the Buddha Dipankara so that Dipankara would not have to step in the mud. And Dipankara, recognizing the enormous faith of this Brahmin youth, predicted that this youth will later become the Buddha Shakyamuni. So we have there the origin of the start of the Bodhisattva path of the Buddha, the future Buddha to be, Shakyamuni. And in the rest of the Jataka tales, we find a whole set of stories. I think there's as many as over 500 stories in the full version. But we find stories there from the past lives of the Buddha. And the Buddha Shakyamuni tells these lives and these stories. And each story illustrates the long and difficult path to Buddhahood of what the Buddha describes as the Mahasatta, the Mahasattva, the great being, or the Bodhisatta, which is the Pali word for Bodhisattva, which is the Sanskrit version. So that each story illustrates a part of the path of the Bodhisattva who becomes the Buddha Shakyamuni. And each of the tales, each of the stories, illustrates one of the 10 perfections that an aspiring Buddha must develop. In the Pali Canon, there's a set of 10 perfections, not 6 perfections that we find later in the Mahayana. The 10 perfections, if you're interested, are generosity, ethical uprightness, patience, vigor, wisdom, renunciation, truth, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. And each story illustrates one of those qualities. So when we look back into the Pali Canon, into the earliest record of the teachings of the Buddha, what we find is a model or a template of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And this has certain features. The first feature is there can be only one Buddha at a time. Secondly, however long their lives, Buddhas must eventually die. And after their death, their Dharma declines and eventually disappears. And only after their death and after the disappearance of their Dharma can a new Buddha appear. Thirdly, Buddhas are very, very rare. To attain the merit and wisdom necessary for a Bodhisattva to become a Buddha takes what's called 3 incalculable eons and 100 great eons. And some people have tried to calculate what that really means in terms of years. One estimate is that the gap in time between Buddhas might be as long as 560 million years, or even 5,600 million years. You know, we're talking about a third of the projected life of total life of the universe. Anyway, I think however it's calculated, it's saying it's a long time between Buddhas. So, you know, longer than we're going to be alive anyway. So the fourth feature of this template of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is someone who dedicates themselves to be a future Buddha, to be one who rediscovers the Dharma, gains enlightenment and teaches others the path to enlightenment. And this Bodhisattva path is very long, traversing many thousands of lives and entails enormous suffering and heroic self-sacrifice. So when you read the Jataka tales, you find lots of varied stories, but there's a lot of stories illustrating heroism and self-sacrifice. So you might be familiar with the story where the future Buddha sacrifices his own life for the sake of a hungry tigress and her cubs, throws himself from a tree so that the tigress has something to eat. And another story, the future Buddha-to-be has to patiently endure whilst an evil king slowly cuts their body to pieces. There's quite a few stories like that. So the path of the Bodhisattva takes a long time and requires a lot of self-sacrifice. This is what we can learn from the Pali Canon. The notion of the Bodhisattva originates in the Pali Canon. So what happens after the Buddha dies is that within a few generations, a change happens. In people's minds, a gap begins to appear between the description of what it is to be a Buddha and what it is to be an enlightened disciple of the Buddha, to be an arhat. Remember I said in the Pali Canon, there's no difference in the quality of enlightenment. Well, actually, what starts to happen is that people begin to think that there is a difference in the quality of enlightenment. And the quality of enlightenment of a Buddha, comes to be recognized as being higher. It's said that Buddha's enlightenment involves a degree of knowledge and insight that is not shared by an arahat. And moreover, it's also emphasized that the attainment of Buddhahood involved the development of a unique physical body that was ornamented with the 32 marks of a great man. And this is a body that's only attained through the accumulation of a massive amount of merit gained over many lifetimes. So in a physical sense, as well as a mental sense, to be a Buddha was therefore to transcend the limitations of an ordinary human being. And we have this gap appearing between the notion of a Buddha and the notion of an arhat. So the status of a Buddha rises and that of the arhats relatively lowers. And it was in this situation that a small number of practitioners within the Sangha chose to deliberately follow the path of the Bodhisattva instead of following the path of the arhat. Instead of seeking enlightenment in this lifetime, they deliberately chose to follow the path of the Bodhisattva. And the model that they followed was very much the model of the Bodhisattva that was found in the Jataka tales of the Pali Canon. And it was a path that was seen as only being suitable for a few good men. And it was men. No women were included in this at that time. It was men. For a few good men. Hence the title of Jannatia's book, For a Few Good Men. So what can we learn about this group of men who embarked upon the Bodhisattva path? We can learn something from the Ugra Sutra. This is one of the earliest Mahayana texts that talks about the path of the Bodhisattva. Well, the first thing that we can learn is there are actually quite a lot of continuities with the Pali Canon. It doesn't sort of have a complete break with the Pali Canon. So first of all, the path of someone who wishes to gain stream entry and become an arhat, to gain enlightenment in this life, is not ridiculed or looked down or disparaged in any way. The path of the arhat is seen as leading to a limited but still worthy and genuine state of enlightenment. And in the Ugra Sutra, this is very interesting, those who choose to follow the Bodhisattva path are specifically warned that they should not in any way feel superior to those following the path of the arhat, nor should they in any way look down on those following the path of the arhats. In the Ugra Sutra, you find no mention of the word Hinayana. You may be aware that in Buddhism you hear these three sort of different kinds of Buddhism, Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. Well, Hinayana means the lesser or inferior vehicle. It's basically a derogatory term. It's a sectarian derogatory term. It's not found in the Ugra Sutra. There isn't that kind of denigration of arhats. So this is because the goal of becoming a Buddha, the goal of Buddhahood, was seen not being in opposition to the goal of arhatship, but it was seen as an addition to the goal of arhatship. And it was a goal that was suitable only for a few heroic and maybe even ambitious men. It required a degree of ambition as well as heroism to start out on this path. We also find in the Ugra Sutra, and this is interesting, that the quality that a bodhisattva is encouraged to develop is not compassion, but it's metta. There's another continuity with the Pali Canon. The emphasis is on metta, on loving kindness. When we look in the Ugra Sutra, we also find that there's a set of bodhisattva vows. They are the unrescued, I will rescue, the unliberated, I will liberate, the uncomforted, I will comfort, and those who have not yet reached parinirvana, I will cause to reach parinirvana. Now, these are similar to vows that you find elsewhere in other Mahayana sutras. But Jahnatir argues that actually the origin of these vows can be found in a more basic form in the Pali Canon, in the Majjhima Nikaya, in a sutta called the Chula Sachaka Sutta. So actually, the vows that we have in the Ugra Sutra seem to have been derived from vows that the Buddha actually uttered. This is what I do. This is what I set out to do. So there's a continuity there. So overall, there isn't a complete break at all between the Pali Canon and the early expression of the Bodhisattva path. And there's no expression of the antagonism that appears in other Mahayana sutras towards those who seek to become arhats, who seek enlightenment in this lifetime. So what did it mean to start off on the Bodhisattva path? If you were one of these men at the time of the Ugra Sutra who actually decided to become a Bodhisattva, what did it mean? It's worth actually taking time to reflect and think, what did it actually mean? Well, first of all, it meant that instead of seeking enlightenment now, you are committing yourself to a path that covered an immeasurable number of lifetimes, to a path where you would have to endure considerable sacrifice in order to become a Buddha who rediscovers the Dharma when the Dharma has disappeared. So you're looking at a very long time ahead. But it's worse than that, because of course, there's already the next Buddha in waiting. Maitreya is in the Tusita heaven, waiting for the Dharma of the Buddha Shakyamuni to disappear, and it's his turn next. So you're going to have to wait until after the death of the Buddha Maitreya and after the disappearance of the Dharma after the Buddha Maitreya. And it gets worse than that, of course, because if there are other people who also want to take the Bodhisattva path, there's no guarantee that it's going to be you that follows the Buddha Maitreya. You could be many, many times down the road, in a long, long time in the future, that you become a Buddha. So the goal of Buddhahood, it's a very small pocket. Let's put it on there. Is it still on? Yeah, okay. You'll have a loud bang. I must have said something that the Buddha disagrees with. Okay. Anyway, the basic idea is this. The goal of Buddhahood is a very, very distant goal indeed. When you take on this path, you're taking on something that is supremely heroic. So that was the situation at the time of the Ugra Sutra. But then, round about the beginning of the Common Era, some of those who were on the Bodhisattva path, who were engaged in deep meditation, emerged from deep meditation with visions of other world systems in addition to our own. And in some of those other world systems, there are Buddhas alive and teaching the Dharma. And in some, there are no Buddhas and no Dharma. So this changes things. This changes things quite a bit. First of all, the rule that there can only be one Buddha at a time is changed. Now the rule is that there can be only one Buddha at any point in time within a particular world system. That still is the case. Secondly, if there are Buddhas alive and teaching now in different world systems, then the chances of a Bodhisattva being reborn in such a world where a Buddha is teaching is very good. And being present to hear teachings from a living Buddha is of great benefit to a bodhisattva and can speed their journey towards full Buddhahood. So that's great. There's a chance of hearing teachings from a living Buddha. Third, if there are world systems where there is no Buddha and the Dharma has been forgotten, Jannati has a really nice word for these worlds. She calls them Buddha-free zones. You know, if there are such Buddha-free zones, then of course the possibilities of fulfilling the wish to full Buddhahood are also increased. There are more places where you can become the Buddha, reintroducing the Dharma. So this does significantly change things, and the potential time on the path to Buddhahood is significantly shortened. So it's still pretty heroic, but it's better than it was. It's better than it was. And Jannatiya looks into the emergence of these Mahayana sutras that start talking about other world systems. And she talks in particular about two emergent Mahayana sutras, one called the Akshobhya-Vyuha Sutra, which introduces the Buddha Akshobhya and his Pure Land Abhirati. And she also talks about early and later versions of the Sukhavati-Vyuha Sutra. This is the sutra where the Buddha Amitabha appears with his Pure Land Sukhavati. So these are emergent Mahayana sutras. And with these emergent Mahayana sutras, we can see the beginnings of divergence in the path of the Bodhisattva. Something starts to change. There are different views of what it takes to become a Buddha in the future that begin to emerge at this time. So when we look in the Akshobhya-Vyuha Sutra, we find that the future Akshobhya, the Akshobhya to be, makes his initial resolution before a Buddha called Great Eyes, the Buddha Great Eyes. And the Buddha Great Eyes initially tries to dissuade the young devotee from making the Bodhisattva vows. He emphasizes to the young devotee, look, do you realize just what you're taking on? You're taking on a really difficult path. So he emphasizes the heroism and sacrifice that's needed over many lifetimes. When you look at the Sukhavati-Vyuha Sutras, what you find there is that Dhammakara, the young man who later becomes the Buddha Amitabha, he appears before the Buddha Lokeshvara Raja to make his vows. And the Buddha Lokeshvara Raja makes no attempt to dissuade Dharmakara from undertaking the Bodhisattva path and says nothing about the difficulties of the Bodhisattva path. And this sort of contrast between the two sutras occurs again when we examine the vows made by the two bodhisattvas, the person to become Akshobhya, the person Dharmakara, who later becomes Amitabha. The future Akshobhya vows that he will undertake ascetic practices in life after life. In other words, it's a very strong emphasis of his knowledge that he will have to undertake seriously difficult practices for life after life. Whereas when you look at the vows of Dharmakara, what you find is that his vows are mostly concerned with the features of the Buddha field or the pure land that he's going to create. And they're mostly concerned with the means by which devotees will gain rebirth in his pure land. So what we see is the Akshobhya-Vyuha Sutra emphasizes the elements of the Bodhisattva path that were present in the Jataka tales, that were present in the Ugra Sutra, that are present as well in the Bodhicharya Avatara of Shantideva. The Sukhavati-Vyuha Sutra does not emphasize those particular elements. Again, we can see a difference in how you get reborn in Akshobhya's Pure Land Abharati compared to how you get reborn in Amitabha's Pure Land Sukhavati. In order to get reborn in Abharati with the Buddha Akshobhya, you have to gain a great deal of merit through many positive actions, through much positive karma over many lifetimes. You don't need to know anything about Akshobhya. You don't need to call his name or anything like that. If you gain merit, you can be reborn in Akshobhya's Pure Land Abharati. But to be reborn in Sukhavati, the Pure Land of Amitabha, there's no mention that you have to accumulate merit through lots of good karmic deeds. What is important is that you know about Amitabha, you bear his name in mind, you repeat his name, homage to Amitabha. So there's quite a big difference there, quite a big difference. There's another difference, actually. In the later version of the Sukhavati Viewer Sutra, the Buddha Amitabha does not appear to die. He has another name, Amitayus, which means limitless life. And the length of life of the Buddha Amitabha is incredibly long, so long that we can, to all intents and purposes, regard him as immortal. So something else changes, whereas the Buddha Akshobhya eventually will die. So there's changes starting to creep in the path of the Bodhisattva and the worlds that they occupy. And there's another big difference in terms of the Sukhavati Viewer Sutra, and that is there, when you look at it, it seems to imply that the Bodhisattva path is accessible to everybody. It's not just accessible to a few heroic people, it's accessible to everybody, men and women and so on. So that when we look at it overall, we find the Sukhavati Viewer Sutra tracing a path for Bodhisattvas that is very different from the ascetic and challenging model of the path found in the Akshobhya Viewer Sutra, found in the Bodhicharavatara, found in the Ugra Sutta, found in the Pali Canon. And instead of many lifetimes, if you follow the path of Amitabha and Sukhavati Pure Land, then the path to Buddhahood may only require this lifetime and the next, because in the next lifetime you will be in Sukhavati, from where you can gain Buddhahood. So there's a definite difference emerges at this time. And if you look at other Mahayana sutras, you see this difference reflected there as well. If you read the Lotus Sutra, the White Lotus Sutra, there, the opening up of the path of the Bodhisattva to all really does get universalized in many ways. It appears that all Buddhist practitioners are on the way to Buddhahood. It said that the spiritual ideal of arhatship is an illusion. Not only that, but that Buddhahood is not the result of many lifetimes of self-sacrifice, but is far, far easier than supposed. And it's said in the White Lotus Sutra that even a child who builds a stupa out of sand will one day become a Buddha. So when we find the Lotus Sutra, it's not just that the path of the Arhat, the enlightened disciples of the Buddha in the Pali Canon, is overturned. The whole notion of a Bodhisattva path with its six perfections and its many lifetimes of sacrifice is also overturned. So when we look into the Mahayana, we find different ideas of the Bodhisattva path and of the Bodhisattva ideal. So great, I thought, Varaka, this is really interesting. Where does it leave us? What the heck does it mean? What does it mean for us now? Where does it leave us? And I had to think this, because otherwise, I mean, what's the point of giving the talk? It's sort of like very interesting looking into history, but if it doesn't tell us something important, what's the point? Well, I think there are a few points we can draw out of this. The first is, unfortunately, when we look at many Mahayana sutras, we find that they denigrate, they put down the path of the Arhat, and they label the early practitioners and the early writings of the Pali Canon as the path of the Hinayana, the inferior vehicle. They use a term basically of sectarian abuse. And this is an attitude that still exists today, unfortunately, sometimes in a very simplistic way. And we're going to give you one example of this unfortunate attitude. It's actually an example. I'm going to quote Thich Nhat Hanh. Now, basically, I quite like Thich Nhat Hanh. I really admire him for what he does as a practitioner and how he teaches the Dharma. But he has a blind spot, and his blind spot is in relation to the Hinayana. He's written a book a few years ago called Nothing to Do, Nowhere to Go. And in that, he writes about arhats and bodhisattvas. And this is what he says. In Theravada Buddhism, the ideal person was the arhat, someone who practiced to attain his own enlightenment. In Mahayana Buddhism, the ideal person was the bodhisattva, a compassionate being who, on the path to enlightenment, helped others. So if we take Thich Nhat Hanh's view, then an arhat is clearly inferior. An arhat lacks compassion compared to a bodhisattva. So the arhat compares very badly alongside the bodhisattva. Now, when we look into the history, we see this is wrong. What we have seen is that the notion of the bodhisattva, the idea of the bodhisattva, originates in the Pali Canon of the Theravadin tradition. And we've seen that the arhats were seen as being equally compassionate as the Buddha. They did not seek enlightenment just for their own benefit. They went out, like the Buddha, to teach others the path to enlightenment. And we know from the Ugra Sutra that in the early Mahayana, there was a much more sensitive and positive appreciation of the worth of the path of the arhat. So we should be careful, therefore, to value the teachings contained in the Pali Canon. And we should be careful, therefore, to avoid slipping into sectarian terminology. It's very easy to talk about the Hinayana, but perhaps instead of using Hinayana, which is a negative term, we could use terms like mainstream Buddhism or Nikaya Buddhism, which is taken from the different Nikayas, that breaking up of the teachings into different groupings, or early Buddhism. If we keep on using the term Hinayana, we're perpetuating a sectarian term. So that's the first point. And second, it's possible to argue, I think, that in relation to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, there is more in common, in some respects, between the Pali Canon and Mahayana Sutras such as the Ugra Sutra, the Akshobhya Viewer Sutra, and Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. There's more in common between the Pali Canon and them than there is between those Mahayana Sutras and other Mahayana Sutras such as the Sukhavati Viewer Sutra and the Lotus Sutra. There's more continuity between the Pali Canon and those Mahayana Sutras I mentioned there first than there is between them and the Sukhavati Viewer Sutra and the Lotus Sutra. This is because the idea of a bodhisattva path, which is followed over many lifetimes, is present in the Pali Canon and is present in the Ugra and Akshobhya Viewer Sutras, as well as in the Bodhicharya Avatara. That kind of path, such a path, with its cultivation of perfections and self-sacrifice, is not present in the Sukhavati Viewer Sutra and in the Buddhist tradition we now know as the Pure Land tradition. It's not present in traditions that are based on the White Lotus Sutra either. So in the Pure Land tradition, it's said that if we open ourselves in this life to the grace of Buddha Amitabha, then we can be reborn in his Pure Land Sukhavati. So the key to that rebirth in Sukhavati is faith in Amitabha. Merit comes not so much from accumulated deeds and actions, but from faith in the grace of Amitabha. So it's a very different approach to the Pali Canon and the early Mahayana Sutras and the Bodhicharyavatara. So how do we reconcile, or can we reconcile, these two very different routes for a bodhisattva, these two very different routes towards Buddhahood? Do we have to choose between one or the other? Or is there a middle way that draws on both paths and gives us something that we can do that's different? And perhaps I think there's an answer to these questions that we can find in the story of the thousand-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. I guess most of you are familiar with this image of Avalokiteshvara, of the thousand-armed, 11-headed. Do we have one around? I don't think we do, do we? But there are many different images of Avalokiteshvara, but this is the one I want to talk about. And there's a story behind this image of the thousand-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. And in the story, the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara makes a vow before the Buddha Amitabha that should he ever become disheartened or dismayed with saving sentient beings, even for a moment, then he says, "May my body be shattered into a thousand pieces. If I ever give in to dismay, may my body be shattered into a thousand pieces." This was the vow that he made, and it was a vow that was symbolic of his great compassion and his great determination. But, the story goes, after a long time, after persistent great effort to help beings, when Avalokiteshvara saw one day that his efforts had made little progress compared to the many beings that remained to be saved, then he became so disheartened and dismayed that, true to his vow, his body shattered into a thousand pieces. And in great pain and despair at the shattering of his body, the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara called out to the Buddha Amitabha for help. And the Buddha Amitabha gave Avalokiteshvara a new body with 1,000 arms and 1,000 hands, with an eye in each hand and 11 heads, so that he could look in all directions. It's a body designed all the better to help sentient beings. And Buddha Amitabha placed his own head at the top of the 11 heads. Now, I really like this story, and I think it has a meaning, or has a possible meaning. This is the meaning that I put on it. If we rely just on our own efforts to help others, if we're too determined and too willful, then we will not succeed. We will experience pain and frustration. But if, in addition to our own efforts, we open ourselves to a force or to a power that is greater than ourselves, then we may succeed. We need to have faith in something beyond ourselves, something that is not limited by myself. And this something has different names and different descriptions. D.H. Lawrence, the English poet and writer, calls this force or power the wind that blows through me. He has this phrase, not I, but the wind that blows through me. And for the aspiring bodhisattva, of course, this force or power is the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, according to Nagarjuna, is not contained in the 5 skandhas. It's not something that is there in our ordinary experience. It's beyond our ordinary experience. And as Bhante says, it's not my bodhicitta. We can't own the bodhicitta. It's something other than us. And Bhante has said that he thinks the bodhicitta is more likely to arise in a community of practitioners involved in some sort of shared project. So if we aspire to be bodhisattvas, if we want to help others to gain enlightenment, then we embark on a path of practice. We work on ourselves through ethics, meditation, and study and reflection. And a central part of our practice is to try to help others. In particular, we try to pass on the Dharma to others. If we gain the Dharma, we don't keep it to ourselves. We want to pass it on to others. Now, there may be periods when we need to practice on our own, but those periods are so that we are better able to engage with and help others. There may be periods when we need to go off and work on ourselves on our own, but that's so that we are better equipped to come back and engage with and help others. But at the same time as following this path of self-development, we need to open ourselves to something beyond ourselves. In a practical sense, maybe this means we need to cooperate with others. We need the shared project of the order, the shared project of the FWBO. We need to open ourselves in that way. And in a more mystical sense, we need to open ourselves to something much deeper or higher than our ordinary selves. Something maybe mysterious, something powerful, something other. Now, we might call this something other D.H. Lawrence's The Wind That Blows Through Me. We might call it the bodhicitta. We might call it the other power and grace of the Buddha Amitabha. But whatever it is, it's something that we need to be open to allow it to arise in us. And I think what it is often best described by poetry. So I'm going to finish with a short few lines from Bhante, from his poem, The Unseen Flower, because I think this captures very well what we need to open ourselves to. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. If they knew it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void.